unless future data of abundance indicates otherwise. I anticipate this limit to go into the next year.
Big reductions for clam harvests on the Kenai. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, heated comments over a proposed Anchorage Assembly ordinance.
This is retroactive justice and trying to justify the decisions made on AO 37. And what I see is an attempt by certain members of this assembly to silence dissent.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
As the Memorial Day weekend approaches, clam diggers on the Kenai Peninsula will have to keep in mind a new set of rules for harvesting razor clams. For the first time in a decade, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is reducing the bag limit for razor clams from 60 per day all the way down to 25. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
The new rules go into effect this week and will be in place for the rest of the year. For clam diggers on all beaches between Kenai and Homer, that means drastically reduced bag and possession limits. The new 25 clam per day bag limit is accompanied by a possession limit of 25. That means clam diggers may only have a maximum of 25 unpreserved razor clams in their possession at any time. That's way down from the normal bag limit of 60 clams per person per day and possession limit of 120 clams. So why such a dramatic reduction?
It's a conservation measure because of the lower abundance of exploitable clams that we've seen on the Nanilchik beaches.
That's fish and game biologist Carol Kirkvliet, who works out of the Homer office. She says the new rules will apply to all beaches between Kenai and Homer, although most of the reduction in razor clam population has been noticed around Nanilchik, where clamming is very popular. Kirkvliet, an avid clammer herself, says the hope is to spread the clam harvest around.
I'll just go to other beaches, and I'll steer away from the Nanilchik beach. I'll either go north or south, but I'll still go clam digging. And for me, actually, 25 clams is more than enough for a day.
In a news release Monday announcing the new rules, Fish and Game officials noted the steep drop-off in the razor clam population over the last couple of years, from approximately 1.5 million clams in 2011 to about 79,000 clams in 2013. The 2013 numbers are the lowest on record for the Nanilchik Beach, based on surveys conducted since 1990. Fish and Game says the cause of the decline is unknown, but is thought to be due to poor spawning and/or settling success. The spawning process for razor clams is interesting and unusual, says Alaska Pacific University professor Brad Hughes, who's been working with Fish and Game to study the clams for the last 3 years. Hughes says that for razor clams to have success, the male and female must be located relatively close to one another.
Because they are broadcast spawners, which means the sperm and the eggs actually get just broadcast out into the water, and fertilization happens externally. And then you have to have synchrony. They have to spawn at the same time, so they have to be cued in on some environmental conditions that tell them, okay, it's time to go.
Hughes says environmental conditions such as tides and water temperature also play a role in the spawning process for razor clams, but scientists are just now getting to know more about their overall life cycle. The last time the bag and possession limits for razor clams were lowered was between 2000 and 2003, when a limit of 45 clams per day was set. Until now, that was the only time the limits have been lowered in more than 50 years. Kirkvliet says it's possible, even likely, that the new limits will extend beyond 2013.
Yeah, I would anticipate that unless future data of abundance indicates otherwise, I anticipate this limit to go into the next year as well, until we do abundance surveys in 2014.
Kirkvliet says that if the Fish and Game team sees greater spawning success among smaller clams at Nanilchik next year, the bag and possession limits could be raised at that time. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Today, the man who was in charge of the Shell drilling rig Kulik when it went aground New Year's Eve testified at a Coast Guard hearing that he had never done a winter tow in Alaska before, but he thought they were prepared for the weather ahead when they left Dutch Harbor 10 days earlier to cross the Gulf of Alaska. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Todd Case has worked for Noble Drilling for more than 20 years, and he can't even remember how many tows he's been involved with. He was in charge of the Kulik when it was towed through the Chukchi Sea in 2012, and he remembers weather bad enough to force the tugs pulling it to turn into the wind. He told investigators that the tug Ivik performed well during that trip. He arrived in Dutch Harbor a couple of days before the Kulik was due to leave, and he said he was confident they had a good plan, and he and his towmaster John Becker were looking at a window of good weather ahead.
We talked about it in meetings. None of us expect to have seas as rough as we had.
And they did get rough. The Kulik's operations manual says if waves start tipping the vessel more than 6 degrees, the tow should be slowed down. The vessel's logbook says on the 27th of December that pitching happened for hours, and Case said he couldn't remember if Becker discussed slowing down with the master of the tug Ivik or not. At about midday, Case was on his way to a lunch break when he got word that the tow had broken. He told Coast Guard investigator Josh McTaggart what happened next.
Out on deck to look at it. Everybody was informed at that time. Somewhere around 11:30, I believe, the tow line parted. And sometime right after 1400, we got it back on the emergency line.
To your recollection, what actually failed on that tow gear?
Shackle.
A shackle is a heavy metal loop that a chain or cable is fixed to. This shackle was never recovered. It wasn't on the Kulik's gear, and it wasn't at the end of the line when the Ivik pulled it in. This was the beginning of a series of problems that would see tows reestablished several times, the failure of the Ivik's engines, the arrival of more vessels, and a plan to try to get the rig to safe harbor somewhere around Kodiak Island. Then an emergency line to the tug Guardsman parted. The storm was intensifying, and the drift toward the shallows was accelerating. It was worse than any situation Todd Case had ever seen, and Barry Strouch of the National Transportation Safety Board asked the inevitable question.
At any point in this, did you believe that your life was in danger?
Again, be hard to say, but if you're drifting toward the bank at 3 knots, and it's 3 hours away, yeah. You would wonder.
Well, what did you do, and you and the other crew members do when you realized that your life may have been in jeopardy?
Well, there wasn't much we could do but wait on other resources to get there. We didn't start crying.
But they might have wanted to start crying. When the Coast Guard helicopter pilot told them the deck was pitching so badly that it was too dangerous to attempt lowering a basket to start evacuating the 18 crew members in the dark. They had to wait for first light. Then on December 29th, a couple of helicopter trips removed the crew, and efforts went on to try to divert the drifting rig, and it grounded on the 31st. During this lengthy probe, each witness has brought another part of the story to light. Case was asked to speculate several times and declined. But when Strouch asked him what hindsight had taught him, he did not hesitate.
Knowing what we know now, we know we should have had multiple tugs.
He's never had to be rescued before, he said. When asked if he felt any pressure to leave Dutch Harbor quickly, Case said no, he did not. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The State of Alaska, North Slope Borough, and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation continue to pressure the federal government over its management of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the Alaskan officials testified before a mostly friendly House committee about a bill that would re-evaluate NPRA.
House Bill 1964 would force the federal government to scrap its current management plan and environmental assessments for new ones, and it would require the federal government to hold annual lease sales in NPRA. Congressman Don Young co-sponsored the bill, but was not there to explain his motives for it because he's big game hunting in Africa. Jamie Connell is the acting deputy director of the Bureau of Land Management. She ticked off a list of reasons why the Bureau opposes the bill, including
the timelines required by the bill that may result in shortcuts to public involvement.
Also,
the suggestion that the department pre-approve rights of ways on millions of acres of lands that industry may never seek to develop.
Connell says the bill's requirement of scrapping existing management plans for a new one undermines the work the agency has already done. She told the Subcommittee on Mineral Resources the BLM supports oil and gas drilling in NPRA, but that was met with disbelief from a troika of Alaskans who say the federal government is blocking development.
Interior's record of decision also made the ability to construct a pipeline across NPRA to pump station one of the Trans-Alaska pipeline more uncertain.
The concern that the North Slope Borough has is the record of decision that was made on the area that we felt would be better served for leasing and not be made into a wilderness area.
Insufficient meaningful consultation with the native landowners or the municipalities within NPRA.
That was Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan, North Slope Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower, and ASRC's Richard Glenn. All are in Washington, D.C. this week, pushing the federal government on its integrated activity plan. The future of the legislation is unclear. It needs to pass the House of Representatives, which is likely to happen, and then pass the Democratic-controlled Senate, which is less certain. As for the future of NPRA, the BLM says it will hold another lease sale in November. One last year drew bids from just two companies that totaled less than $1 million. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska-based soldier competes in the best warrior competition in Hawaii.
The sounds of battle are real. The sweat is in your eyes. You're running through jungle. You can't see 15, 20 feet in front of you. You don't really know what's happening until you get around the next corner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
A massive ice jam 12 miles upriver from Fort Yukon partially let loose early this morning. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says the ice sheet hasn't broken entirely, but water backed up behind it is starting to move downriver.
With the ice jam partially open and water being released, this is definitely a good situation because now we don't have water just being built up back behind the ice jam. So this will lessen the threat of a sudden release of water coming down the Yukon River and water levels rising quickly in Fort Yukon.
Low-lying areas of Fort Yukon are still seeing some flooding. Ed Plum says communities like Beaver and Stevens Village further downriver still face a serious threat of high water from ice jamming. The National Weather Service and the Alaska Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management flew over the river at Fort Yukon this morning. They will continue to monitor the situation. Another sign of this year's slow arrival of spring, green-up will likely be the latest in Fairbanks' recorded history. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
It's looking pretty brown around Fairbanks, an upgrade from the white of just a few days ago, but well short of the green normal for this time of year. National Weather Service meteorologist Rick Toman says on average, buds start bursting on trees during the first or second week of May.
But this year is going to be one of the latest green-ups in many years. In the last 30 years or so, the latest green-up has been on May 25th, but we are certain to go past that date this year.
Fairbanks' official late green-up record was set in 1992. Green-up is judged by the Weather Service in Fairbanks by looking at the trees on the Chena Ridge hillside. Toman says the change from brown to green is usually pretty abrupt and hinges on temperature.
The trees need some spell of warm weather to get the leaves to pop out, and we've done some work on trying to estimate that. using various temperature statistics. And our current best guess would be that green-up would be about May 28th.
Toman says there's potential for breaking Fairbanks' unofficial late green-up record of May 30th, set in 1964 during a cold spring, he says, tracked very similar to this year's. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Last night, the Anchorage Assembly voted unanimously to postpone indefinitely an ordinance that would have changed the way public hearings are conducted. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
The Assembly has made a habit of moving public testimony to the end of its meetings, so it wasn't a surprise that they did so with an ordinance meant to overhaul the public hearing system. Richard Evans of Spinard protested and was allowed to testify earlier because he said he had to return to work. He said the ordinance was bad.
This is retroactive justice. A gentleman in the audience told me about this earlier, trying to justify the decisions made on AO 37. And what I see is an attempt by certain members of this assembly to silence dissent, people who are dissenting against what appears to be, to me at least, is a personal attack on the people in this city. I came here unprepared with my notes. When I heard about this, I jetted over here as fast as I could, interrupting my job, because this is very important to me.
Assembly Chair Ernie Hall crafted the ordinance with help from the ACLU of Alaska. It was a response to crowded public hearings during testimony on AO 37, a law limiting unions, which was passed in March after weeks of packed public hearings that the body voted to close before everyone had a chance to testify. The new ordinance would have required people to sign up on the first evening of a public hearing in order to testify, even if the hearing was continued. New Assembly member Amy Demboski said she thought the ordinance would create more order in a haphazard process. But Sheila Selkrig, a university professor and former Anchorage Assembly member, said the new ordinance was too limiting because it wouldn't allow people to respond to laws as they're being crafted.
I waited on AO 37 because I wanted to know what the S version was. I didn't want to speak at the beginning to something that really wasn't full of content.
Some said requiring people to sign up on the first night of testimony would limit those with night work and family and community obligations from participating in city politics. Deborah Kelly, who wore a sweatshirt with a union logo on the back, said she works for the city, along with many who do 24-hour shift work and who might be kept from testifying if the ordinance passed.
They're not always able to come to assembly meetings, and I really think that they should have the opportunity to make their thoughts known. I mean, a person caring for an ailing family member, should they not have the same rights as other citizens? I realize it's a messy process sometimes, but democracy is supposed to be messy. I mean, it's supposed to be messy, but in the end, it's supposed to be fair, and it's got to look fair.
After hearing from the public, the Assembly voted unanimously to postpone the issue indefinitely. Assembly Chair Hall said he was disappointed because the Assembly had not developed a protocol that addressed the issue of how to conduct public hearings involving large numbers of people, an issue that he said was sure to eventually come up again. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson soldier is competing this week in the Pacific Army Reserve Best Warrior competition in Hawaii. The week-long competition began Saturday and will end with an awards ceremony tomorrow. APRN's Josh Edge has the story.
The past week has been exhausting for Sergeant Daniel Alsdorf. From before the sun rises until after it sets, he and 10 other soldiers have been putting their entire military skill set to the test. From land navigation to hand-to-hand combat to their overall fitness and more. And, according to Alsdorf, the Hawaiian heat and humidity coupled with a simulated battlefield atmosphere haven't made the tests any easier.
It's amazing when you get to a competition how some of the simple tasks become hard, and you add a little sleep deprivation and a little fatigue to that. You know, 6.5-hour road march and Hawaiian conditions can be pretty intense, especially coming from Alaska. These boys have a 30-degree temperature advantage on me.
Despite the difference in climate between Hawaii and Alaska, he says he's feeling pretty good about the competition so far. Alsdorf is a combat medic, and he was able to put his life-saving skills to work during the combat casualty care exercise, where competitors had to take care of two injured soldiers and move them to a helicopter before time ran out. all while under simulated combat conditions.
The sounds of battle are real. The sweat is in your eyes. You're running through jungle. You can't see 15, 20 feet in front of you. You don't really know what's happening until you get around the next corner. All the while, you know that there's someone in there bleeding, and it's your job to get to them and save their lives before they lose all their blood.
Even though the two casualties are mannequins, Alsdorf says it doesn't stop the soldiers from doing all they can to save them.
You have to start to sort of think on your feet, make sure you're running through your fundamentals, like, you know, are they breathing? Can we stop the bright red stuff from coming out of their body? Can we get them to safety? All those things are a lot harder than it sounds whenever you've got 50 caliber rounds, you know, blasting over your head, and it's pretty exciting.
Competitors won't know exactly where they stand in the competition until tomorrow at the awards ceremony. The winners will go on to the U.S. Army Reserve Command's Best Warrior Competition in Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, later this year. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Heavy cloud cover over the Alaska Peninsula is making it tough for scientists to monitor Pavlov Volcano. The Alaska Volcano Observatory hasn't been able to get a clear picture of the peak by satellite for almost 2 days. According to pilots' reports today, the volcano is still erupting, but the ash plume has dropped from 20,000 feet to 10,000 or less and is blowing out to sea. That's good news for regional airlines, which canceled flights to Southwest Alaska this week over concerns that the ash would damage their planes. Pan Air President Danny Siebert says the airline restored all of its routes today and started adding some extra planes to work off a backlog of more than 300 passengers. The Knik Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, or KABATA, wants an independent source to review findings of a state audit of revenue projections that almost swamped the Knik Arm Bridge project in the waning hours of this year's legislative session. KABATA spokeswoman Shannon McCarthy says the new study will update the project's traffic and socioeconomic data while providing a peer review of the data called into question by opponents of the bridge project.
We need to take a look at what's been happening and revisit our numbers. They were put together in 2007, so it's time to go ahead and update those numbers, make sure that we have all the right numbers going into our model. And then the second reason is because the socioeconomic data was called into question, we're asking professional economists to take a look at our numbers, take a look at all of the work that's been done in terms of socioeconomic forecasting, and to take a look at that and see if the numbers are good and if they're used appropriately.
KABATA has issued a request for proposals for bids from firms that may be interested in reviewing and updating the data. Proposals are due June 6th, and a report is expected by fall. In an earlier statement, McCarthy said that KABATA is still the legal entity with authority over the Knik Arm Bridge project, although that status too has come into question after the State House passed an amendment to a KABATA funding bill that would have given authority to build the bridge to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The Senate did not pass the amendment, however, leaving the fate of KABATA undetermined. The Parnell administration says it will appeal the dismissal of its lawsuit over the roadless rule in the Tongass National Forest. Meanwhile, faced with no participation by the state government and limited participation by environmental groups, the Tongass Futures Roundtable Group has decided to shut down. The organization was formed to resolve Southeast Alaska forestry issue conflicts. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Tongass Futures Roundtable formed about 7 years ago. Organizers hope to bring together all parties involved in the forest to craft compromises on land use issues such as logging and habitat protection.
The roundtable brought people together who had never had to sit across from each other at a table. The normal environment was a courtroom.
Bruce Botello has been the group's facilitator and moderator. The former Attorney General and Juneau Mayor says roundtable members decided to end their work during a meeting earlier this month.
One of the benefits for us to dissolve right now is to create the opportunity for people to come together and perhaps learn from our experience, but also build on it. And one would hope that any assembly of stakeholders would truly bring back the whole range of participants.
Membership originally included industry, government, tribal, and environmental leaders, but about 2 years ago, the state, timber representatives, and some conservation groups pulled out.
We didn't have enough movement in the direction that we felt needed to occur.
State forester Chris Mish was one of the original roundtable members.
So the governor decided it would be best to put the state energy and time and resources into a task force, which he established through an administrative order.
Mish chaired that task force, which released its final report a few months ago. It recommended a number of actions meant to increase logging. One called for the federal government to turn 2 million acres of the Tongass over to the state to be managed for harvest. Mish says the timber task force has since shut down. Botello says the roundtable will cease operations July 1st, but he says it achieved some of its goals.
We devoted a great deal of time to examining the proposed mental health land exchange between the state and the trust, and ended up endorsing a process which is underway.
The Tongass Futures Roundtable had about 35 members and tried to reach decisions by consensus. State Forester Mish says that just didn't work.
Unfortunately, it just wasn't the right time and the right place. It's too bad that it didn't come to a better conclusion.
The roundtable had funding support from the Rasmussen Foundation and other donors. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.